Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is the answered question from WCRB in Boston for June 2nd, 2017. This is Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 4, recorded last summer at the Rockport Chamber Music Festival. It's the Chameleon Arts Ensemble, and you'll hear the entire piece this Sunday evening at 7 p.m. on WCRB in concert. Deborah Bolden is the founder and leader of the Chameleon Arts Ensemble, and she's one of the guests on this podcast. Also on the podcast today is Hélène Grimaud, the pianist who performed both Brahms piano concertos with the Boston Symphony Orchestra last fall. Over the next few Saturdays, starting tomorrow night, we'll bring you three BSO broadcasts that include those two concertos, the four symphonies by Brahms, and two new works commissioned by the BSO, one by Eric Nathan and the other by Timo Andras. Tomorrow, the Chameleon Arts Ensemble wraps up its 2016-2017 season with a free family concert at the Hyde Park Library in Boston. And then they'll be on the stage of the Shaolin Lu Performance Center on June 18th for a Rockport Chamber Music Festival concert. It'll be the group's second consecutive summer appearing at that festival, and last year's concert is the one WCRB will bring you on Sunday with music by Bach and his sons. And when my friend and colleague Kathy Fuller got together with Deborah Bolden, the artistic director of the ensemble, she asked Deborah what motivated her to start the group in the first place.
I'm a flutist as well as the artistic director of Chameleon. And when I got out of school, I was a little bit aimless, to be honest. I didn't know who I was going to be when I grew up. And I always loved playing with other people in small combinations where you're in a room together and you can kind of hash out what the music is and what it means to you and what you want to communicate about it. And I realized that you don't typically fall into jobs in which you can do that every day. So you have to make your own job. And so I founded the group in order to be able to both perform myself, but to create opportunities for other musicians to uncover new works, to investigate old beloved works that, you know, come up through, you know, all of history that people really are connected to, and to create a vehicle for them to express themselves.
Well, congratulations on coming up 20 years with the Chameleon Arts Ensemble. That's a great thing. The Boston Globe, I think, once said, I've read it in your materials, that planning a good chamber music concert is a delicate art. Why do they say that?
Well, I'm not entirely sure exactly what he meant, but I approach it like a delicate art. I approach it like a puzzle. So I figure out, first of all, some perhaps extra musical idea that I want to explore. So, for instance, it might be the idea of memory or love or just something that has a human quality. And then I start looking for music, both old and neglected and new music that speaks to that kind of basic human quality, and then I puzzle it together until it becomes a Chameleon program. And the process can take sometimes several years before it reaches audiences.
It sounds like fun, but it also sounds like it could wake you up in the middle of the night at times.
Well, the thing that I find sometimes difficult is that there's so much amazing music out there, and the fact that I can't present all of it is sometimes a little bit painful for me. I want to get it all out, but I've learned over the course of the last almost 20 years now that there's always more music to be written, to be heard, and to be presented, and there's always more concerts ahead, and so we just proceed in a way that with full heart and with joy in the hopes of being able to reach as many people as possible.
Well, you got this grant to make programs that kind of reveal the effect of Bach on future generations of musicians, right? So much has been written about Bach. Why is he so soothing? Why does he give so much solace? What does he do? Have there been any surprises as you've been playing so much Bach toward this program and this idea?
Well, I find music surprising always. It's constantly amazing me. And one of the great things about Bach's music in and of itself is that there's always more to discover around the corner. And so it's not surprising to me that composers like Shostakovich and Mendelssohn or contemporary composer like Per Norgard, all of these we performed in the fall, would find inspiration or could derive whole works from, you know, bits of Bach that teaches us so much.
The biggest misunderstanding about Bach, I mean, people, you talked about puzzles earlier. I mean, I think sometimes people think there's this intellectual quality of Bach because everything fits together so well and it's complex. That couldn't be farther from the truth, could it?
I completely agree. I think Bach is nothing but joy. And to marvel at the craftsmanship is one thing, but to just open up your ears and allow yourself to take this music in, that's when it becomes joy. And for me, that's the most important aspect of all music.
So this is a family show. This is Bach and his millions of children. I mean, we tend to think, oh, he had so many children. He had two wives, and he had some children with his first wife, and then he had 13, I think, with his second wife.
But 20 total.
20 total children, and it wasn't easy to take care of them all, and he was always scrambling. But let's start with Wilhelm Friedemann. Apparently, generations of people got mad at him because he lost a lot of his father's scores, which is unfortunate. He lost a lot of his own, too. But is there something distinctive about this piece that you begin the program with? It's a sinfonia, two flutes, that's one of them is you, right, and strings and continuo.
Well, I chose it because of the second move. It's built in two parts, as an adagio and a fugue. And I think that W.F., if you don't mind if I call him W.F. Bach, because if we start talking about Bach, we don't know which of these Bachs right. We're talking about. But I think the orchestral music of W.F. is some of his most wonderful and most interesting and exploratory music, along with his keyboard works. And I chose this one in particular because of the second movement fugue. It's extremely finely crafted. It's very alive and vibrant. And it opens our program. At the end of the program, we're going to hear his father's, J.S. Bach's, fourth Brandenburg Concerto, which also ends with a fugue. And I loved this idea of kind of bookending the program with these two extremely alive and colorful fugues.
Johann Christian Bach, so he's J.C. Bach. He's the one who was known as the London Bach. And I know Mozart really revered and loved him a lot and learned a lot from him. This piece by J.C. Bach features an oboe. And anytime I think oboe and Baroque music, I think a voice, and there's going to be a lot of passion in here. Is that true?
I think this piece has a lot of buoyancy, actually. So it certainly has a singing quality, and which the oboe always brings to the table, right? But the buoyancy and verve of the piece is, for me, the more interesting aspect. And the other thing that he does, a little technical thing that folks might be able to hear, is that he takes the inner voices and allows them to occupy more of the melodic material than normally. So that would be J.C. Bach's innovation here in the chamber music, which, as so far as style goes, is the works that we can hear him taking the turn toward the classical style, toward Mozart, more than his brothers.
I see. So if people might not know what an inner voice is, those are the voices that you would think of as being accompaniment more, right?
Yes. So in this case, we have a oboe, violin, they would be the two solo voices, and then viola, cello, and harpsichord. And so we hear some solo viola moments in this piece, which is quite remarkable.
C.P.E. Bach is one of my favorites. I love him. You can still get his treatise, his book about how to play the keyboard on Amazon. You can go on there right now. I think he would be very happy about this and buy this book. I mean, it's still relevant. He is a passionate character, C.P.E. Bach. Tell me about this piece that comes up by C.P.E.
Well, I think it really exemplifies all of the wonderful things about C.P.E. Bach. It's extremely colorful. It's filled with fantasy and characters and bold contrast. In it, the two violins take on two different characters. One is happy and optimistic, and the second one is sad and melancholy. And they trade their lines back and forth in their in their designated characters, and in the instructions for the piece, CPE tells them to try to imitate one another. And so it becomes this extremely imaginative and dialogue between the two instruments. That's two people.
That's amazing. It sounds almost operatic, but they are referred to, and I people may not know and or forget about these sort of humors that were considered an important way of understanding people and their characters. The four humors, and he's using two of them in this book, but in this piece, there's the sanguine, right?
Yes.
That's outgoing, right?
Outgoing and happy and bubbly personality.
Right? The melancholic is the introverted one.
Yes.
And phlegmatic is what? Calm and I think just patient, a little bit more serene. And then there's choleric or choleric, which is extroverted and very impatient. It's sort of,
insistent,
ready to lose his temper, right? So he uses the two, sanguine and melancholy, right, for
yes.
these two. And so those are the characters.
And that's the subtitle of the piece as well. So it's a trio sonata with sanguine and melancholy characters.
Does it have a happy ending?
Well, I think in the end it's all very happy, but the most happy part is experiencing the audience watching or listening to the happy character in the violin trying to cajole the sad one to join in the happiness.
Let's talk about the fourth Brandenburg Concerto. When we get around to the end of the concert, we get to the father. Somebody called him the prime arbiter once. He's J.S. From him all things flow, I think. But the fourth one has a real virtuoso violin part, certainly, right?
Yes, so it's scored for violin solo along with two flauti di ecco. And scholars don't know for sure what this flauti di ecco means. Some people have tried to interpret it as soprano recorders or some kind of tin whistles that were prevalent at the time, but actually sound an octave higher than written. But most people now agree that it refers to the loud, soft echoing of the flutes to the violin line in the middle movement, in the andante.
Are these pieces, which are so loved, there are six Brandenburg concertos, what is the experience of playing them? Do you feel the joy, or are you so busy keeping everybody together that it's, can you let go of all the work and feel the excitement of it?
Well, for me personally, it was performing, I performed on two of the six, because there's not flute on all of them, shockingly, but I thought it was one of the most joyful experiences performing live in my life, really, because not only do you feel the joy of this incredible repertoire and this masterpiece and a composer whom, for all of us who study music and all of us who love music, stands as this towering figure, a singular genius. And there's something about these works that allows you to take this in, and you can feel the audience join you in this joy in the moment of performance. And it was unlike anything I could have ever experienced before.
Talk to me about chameleons in the community. What is that?
Well, these are our community outreach programs, and we have three arms of this program. We have an annual music education series, and we work with several schools in the Boston Public Schools system, and we present a free family concert every spring at the Hyde Park Branch Library. And then we also have a free ticket program. We donate tickets to students, to public service agencies for their constituents, so that it removes a barrier for people who want to participate in the arts, and they can come and enjoy music at no cost. And we benefit from their energies as well, and it's a win-win for everyone. And then also at our spring concert, our spring chamber music concert each year, we host a benefit event for a local public service charity, and we collect, sometimes it's non-perishable food, sometimes it's books, or might be winter clothing or something like that. And we give our audiences an opportunity to be connected with the community by donating items, and then they can have a discount off of their ticket prices. So it's a way to keep us all connected and remind us all to stay connected in community.
What do you think about the 20th anniversary season? Are you planning that already? It's a big party, isn't it?
I hope it will be a big party. Yes, we are very, very excited. And we'll be announcing the season probably in June. So I don't want to give too much away. I will say that it was a couple of months ago, received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. And we'll be, with that, be presenting a performance of Aaron Copland's original 13-player version of Appalachian Spring.
That's fantastic. That isn't hard enough, I think, that smaller version. Do you think that bringing people into classical music for the first time, that chamber music, you know, music in an intimate sort of scale that's sort of, that has so much of a conversant quality about it, is a good way to bring people in? Is that a better way than a huge orchestra and a huge hall?
Well, there are pros to both of these things. There's a great thing about being in a big orchestra hall with sound that comes at you from all directions. I mean, that's a thrilling experience. For chamber music, the experience of seeing three people on the stage communicate, no holds barred, to craft an idea of a piece of music, that's incredibly thrilling as well. And it's a different way of approaching.
Do you ever think about sort of stagecraft or lighting, or is it something that you need to worry about when you're presenting?
I never think about that kind of stuff. I only care about presenting really heartfelt and really meaningful performances of music that I believe in wholeheartedly and that I think will be meaningful for listeners. And so that could range anything from Bach, Mozart, Schubert to music that's been neglected, you know, in the middle of, say, mid-century, 20th century music that's been neglected, or something that's just recently been written. We can have connections with all of it.
All right, let's play a game where I say the name of one of the composers and you just say one word or two words about what he's like, okay? So if I say to you, C.P.E. Bach.
Quirky.
J.C. Bach.
Elegant.
J.S. Bach.
Sublime.
W.F. Bach.
Dark.
Those are great. When people are coming to hear Bach for the first time, in a way, it's music that we've all heard before, right? I mean, when you bring somebody in and maybe they've never gone to a concert that has Bach in it, like this one, do you feel like they'll come away with it having learned something or just having been immersed in something?
Well, I hope it's a little bit of both. I don't particularly like the idea of thinking that if I'm presenting music in a concert that I'm trying to teach you something. I'm trying to give an experience that you're going to hold with you. You're going to carry this music. Maybe you're not going to be whistling it, but it's going to be part of your lifeblood after you leave. And it's not meant to show you what you don't know, but to invite you in to be part of something that will make you happy. It's quite simple, actually.
There's a kind of thrill about seeing music happen in a smaller venue with smaller numbers of people, because we can watch the theme get thrown around sometimes, like in a fugue, or whereas if you're just listening, it can be a little harder to grab it. Do you think that helps when we're watching you as well as listening to you?
Well, I can tell you from on stage, you can feel the attention and the energies of the audience, and you feed off of it, and they receive back, right? And when I'm an audience member, because I'm a great lover of music, I love to listen to music, I love to go to concerts, seeing the communication, like witnessing that on stage is really exciting. And you can, it's almost like if there was a thought bubble right outside of the violinist's head and you could see the notes coming above them and they pass the line to the cellist and then they have a thought bubble and you can, it's almost, you could map that out in your head.
It is like a sort of an emotional map I think it is helpful. You said David DeVoe really wanted a Bach and Family concert. He's at least through this year, the director of the Rockport Chamber Music Festival. And I guess Bach is important to all keyboard artists, but important to everybody. How is it, this beautiful venue? Is it inspiring to play in front of a gigantic window overlooking the sea?
It's overwhelming when you come into the hall for the first time and you see the sea out through the windows and take your instrument out of the case and turn and are faced with beautiful stage, beautiful wood, all of the trappings of a glorious concert hall.
Deborah Bolden, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah Bolden and the Chameleon Arts Ensemble are on the air this Sunday at 7 on WCRB in concert with Rockport Music. And you have the chance to hear the Chameleons in that beautiful space in Rockport again later this month on June 18th, when they'll be back at the Rockport Chamber Music Festival with music by Beethoven, Bartok, Berio, and Bloch. That's right, all B's. You'll find more info at the In Concert page of classicalwcrb.org. Tomorrow night at 8, in an encore broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Hélène Grimaud is the soloist in the first piano concerto by Brahms with music director Andras Nelsons. When I met with her at Symphony Hall after a rehearsal last fall, I asked her whether her relationship to the Brahms piano concertos has changed over the years.
Yeah, definitely in the case of the first piano concerto, it's true, it's a concerto I've now lived with for 25 years, more actually, and 30, oh, scary. Anyway, and yes, of course it does, it changes with, well, first of all, you know, pieces have a way of developing a life of their own, even within yourself when you're not actively engaged with the pieces. Let's say there is a phase where you're not playing them very often or even not at all for a few years. It's always amazing to me how when you start again, they've evolved into something else. So, I mean, that's what keeps this passion so fascinating, because you always have to adapt and you always have to grow, because otherwise it's pretty much over. And pieces, of course, also have an influence on each other. So depending on what else you're working on, it's going to influence your views on certain subjects. And so it's a wonderful journey with a piece like, especially the first concerto, where something that he wrote when he was so young. And for me, what makes the piece so exceptional is that it is the last one where he really shows who he is without any distance at all. There's no mechanism in place for self-preservation, no emotional distance at all. It's totally raw, totally impulsive.
That's kind of an amazing state. Tell me more about that. What is it in the second concerto that you hear as that kind of distance or mechanism?
Well, it's something which is so carefully crafted, and some of the violence and the impulsiveness. You know, also it's so interesting when you read what Robert Schumann wrote about Brahms in his young years, and that's in total conflict with what people often think about Brahms and how it should be played, because that, you know, when you read about how impulsive, again, the character was, I mean, someone who was just climbing up the stairs 4x4, banging on doors, no patience whatsoever, very extreme in his opinions and his likes, his dislikes. It's interesting because people don't think of Brahms as that type of character. And I do believe that no matter how many years later, the core of the temperament, of the personality remains unchanged. But there are so many layers that come to build themselves over the years. That's the way I feel the piece very much.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the difference that we think of, that there's the young, talented, but insecure and impetuous Brahms and the master who puts together this second concerto. But it's fascinating to hear you characterize it as maybe a little bit of distance. The core is still there, but a little bit of distance. Have you done the two concertos in such close proximity like this before?
I have done them in two consecutive days, so in a way even closer, although only on one occasion. It's a wonderful chance to be doing both concertos four times each. I mean, this is a great opportunity, and I'm very happy to be part of this fantastic combination with Andras and the orchestra.
Well, and you recorded these pieces with Andras, so is this kind of picking up where you left off, or have you found that working with Andras again, there's a little twist that you may not have expected?
Well, it's both. Going back to what we were saying, where of course, when there is this affinity, this type of sort of, you know, musical compatibility, then you do pick up where you left off on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, every set of circumstances is unique. So being here with the Boston Symphony is, of course, a totally different story than with Bayerisch Rundfunk or Vienna Philharmonic. And that's the wonderful thing, is that you react to every sound which is produced. So you don't just go out and do only what you planned on doing. Conception is one thing, but then you have to be able to do the piece and willing to do the piece in a chamber music character as well, where you react to every impulsion from the orchestra and phrasing and color. And that's going to change everything. And that goes for Andres as well.
Yeah. If I can ask about something that I think is still true of yourself, which is the synesthesia. And it's not often that, you know, I think we get to hear from someone directly who characterizes themselves this way. Synesthesia, the quality of seeing colors or images triggered by music in a very vivid way. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Is that a constant, for instance, in the Brahms First? Does that phenomenon remain no matter who you're playing with, or does it depend on the circumstances, like you were just describing in the different interpretations with Andres?
It is more or less vivid. I'm not sure I can really exactly pinpoint what causes it to be more or less present, but it's fairly basic in the sense that for me, it's really the color of the tonality. So D minor is always blue. It doesn't really matter if it's D minor, Bach, or Beethoven, or Brahms, or Prokofiev. And so with every modulation in the piece, the color is going to change. But the dominant color is going to be the color of the tonality in which the piece was written.
Okay. That's really helpful. That's good. I mean, it's just not an experience that most of us can truly relate to. I think everybody gets some images in their minds, but that's really interesting. Do you find the Brahms of these concertos to be the same Brahms as you find in solo pieces or in chamber music?
I say yes, because his piano music is extremely orchestral by nature. There is such a contrapuntal element also, so many voices, inner voices, and the architecture of the piece. You know, Andres says something very interesting about Brahms, about how it's so wholesome in feeling, that there's something very cleansing in a way. There is such a purity of form, something absolutely non-compromising. The proportions of the architecture, the musical architecture, are absolutely perfect, and that you find very much in the piano music, along with all those textures and this element of you know, verticality as well as horizontality in the music, which makes it very orchestral.
And again, about something kind of off stage, I'm interested in the conservation center for wolves, and how that sort of emerges. Something you wanted to, I think I know the story, the sort of narrative of how that came to be. But tell me how present that is in your life. This the Wolf Conservation Center, and what is that moves inside of you that makes that meaningful?
Well, the Wolf Center has grown a lot since the years that I was working on founding it, co-founding it, and so. You know, started building the physical facility in 1997, started to work on the issue already in 93, 94, opened officially in 99, got our 501c3 status. Well, now it's, you know, 3.5 million people on Facebook, tens of thousands of visitors every year on site, even more off site, with the help of our amazing Arctic Wolf traveling ambassador, Atka. The resident pack at home on site, and then, of course, all the SSP animals, Mexican wolves, Red Wolves. So it's a fantastic organization. I'm very, very proud. But it has grown a lot. There's now a big team of staff and volunteers. And being that I moved back to the U.S. Recently, I'm now geographically, again, closer to the organization. But of course, it is a different phase than in the early years, where you are busy with every aspect of getting such an organization started. And gathering support and bringing volunteers on board and all of those things. So, but that's what I was hoping. I mean, I wanted the organization to be able to survive me. And it's in a place to easily do that now with the staff, the volunteers, and the board in place, so it's wonderful.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the character of wolves themselves, I mean, they are fascinating creatures. I spent, honestly, a little bit of time several years ago really fascinated with the social structure, but also the way that wolves play in our culture, in people's perceptions. And I wonder which of those is sort of the more energizing factor for you.
Well, the latter was a great part of what motivated me to start the Wolf Center to begin with, is this divide, this discrepancy between what people perceive of wolves and what they truly are. So it was definitely one of the great motivators to start an environmental education organization, to sort of clear that, because of course what people are afraid of they want to destroy. In the beginning, my first intention was to put together a rescue facility when I realized what a situation there was with hybrids or high-content hybrids in private hands, even with the best intentions at heart. That always leads to something which negatively reflects on the wolves themselves. And so that and the fact that you have to then constantly subdivide your resources, be it, you know, space or resources by the number of animals you take in, and it's a wonderful thing, and I have the utmost respect for people who devote their lives to such an endeavor. But I then chose to go with the environmental education aspect because I believe there is no long-term hope for conservation without education. That's really the biggest obstacle to the recovery of these highly controversial animals.
Yeah. Let's veer back on stage now for one last question. Some of your recent projects have been really fascinating combinations of music and even physical setting, and I think of water and Credo even. I wonder if you can say anything about what we might be looking forward to from you along those lines. I imagine you're not sort of completely played out with those kinds of imaginings. What can we look forward to from you in the coming years?
Well, it's a little early to be revealing some of those, but you're absolutely right. There are some projects in the pipeline because it's such a fascinating avenue to be combining different art forms, and I think it can make the journey even more intense for some people. At the same time, you know, there are always two ways of looking at it. You know, sometimes people talk about how classical music, something has to be done. Well, no, it really suffices itself. I mean, for me, that's nothing better than sitting in a beautiful hall, which is acoustically gorgeous with, you know, hearing a beautiful ensemble, and the urgency of a live interpretation on stage. What more does one want? So again, there are always two ways of looking at it. That said, it's also good to keep a sense of adventure and try different things. And they don't all, you know, fly. But it doesn't matter. Most of them you do anyway for the journey and for the experience. But the ones that I've been lucky to realize so far in combination with other artists have been very satisfying. And so, of course, it's a motivation to keep looking down that road. But I suppose that's always going to be the minority of what I do.
Great. Well, we'll still look forward to the next one, whatever it is. I'm anxious to see what happens next. So, Hélène Grimaud, thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you back in Boston.
Thanks to you. Thanks for your time.
Hélène Grimaud is the soloist in the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Brahms with the Boston Symphony Orchestra and Andres Nelsons in an encore broadcast recorded last fall, tomorrow night at 8 on WCRB. That's TAQ for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find us on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Deborah Bolden of the Chameleon Arts Ensemble and to Hélène Grimaud. And thanks also to Kathy Fuller. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.